Okay, I'm going to call the House Energy and Environment Committee to me to order. Today we have an informational hearing meeting that's going to take up a number of topics. The first will be irrigation modernization, and then at the end we'll hear from the Secretary of State about their most recent audit. Just to preface, committee, the reason for an informational hearing at this time, there are several bills in this committee now, and we've already dealt with one of them about the needs of the Oregon Water Resources Department and the needs of managing water better in this state. And the Secretary of State's audit highlighted some of the issues that as a state we need to take care of. The Oregonian ran an expose this summer with a four-part series that looked at accountability and how we use our water in the state, both surface water and groundwater. And I wanted to take that up this session. And I thought the best way to get at this is to talk with some people that actually work with water on the ground. And that's what our informational session is composed of today. And I want to thank everybody that has traveled to be here today to share your expertise with us at the very beginning. So with that, I'll get going on the first panel. And come on up, April, Julie O'Shea, and J.R. Cook. And the next panel will be Les Perkins and Mike Tripp. We've got about an hour for the five of you if you need it all. And thanks for being here again, and start when you're ready.
Thanks, Chair Helm, Vice Chair Johnson, Vice Chair Power, members of the committee. I'm April Snell, Executive Director with the Oregon Water Resources Congress. We represent irrigation districts and other similar entities around the state. And it's my pleasure and privilege to be here before you to say a few words about irrigated agriculture in Oregon, some of the economic value that it provides, and some of the larger issues that we face as an industry that will hopefully help illuminate some of these issues as you move forward this session and as you tackle different bills and different funding issues before you. So I have a little bit of a PowerPoint. Good thing is that there's lots of pictures, which for this time of the day, hopefully will help. But also, hopefully, the lights won't lull you to sleep as well. So just briefly, irrigated agriculture, most broadly, is not only the members I represent, which are irrigation districts that deliver water, but also the farmers, ranchers, and other water users who put that water to beneficial use under Oregon water law. And there are whole lots of ways that they put that water to good use, and there are different ways that they procure that water. And the important thing from this slide here is that more than 75% of Oregon's harvested crop value is produced using irrigation water from streams and rivers, that's surface water, and that irrigated land is worth far more than non-irrigated land. And in Oregon, we are divided in many ways by the Cascade Mountains, and on the west side where we are, the wet side as it is today, we get a lot of abundant rainfall, and that is primarily what irrigates the lands. Although there are irrigation districts, there are reservoirs and other large water supply projects, but the bulk of the huge water supply infrastructure is on the east side, where rainfall is not as predominant and where you need a lot more assistance to get that water to crops around the state. Oregon agriculture is a big deal. It is something that doesn't benefit a single individual. It's something that provides great economic value to the state. There are many crops that are the cornerstone of Oregon's agriculture, and I won't read all of those here, but we are pretty phenomenal when it compares to other states with the commodities that we produce, and all of those commodities are dependent on reliable, adequate water supplies. So the manner in which that goes to the fields varies quite broadly, just as the crops that are produced from them. And just a few pretty pictures there for you to be able to see some of that. And those crops, whether it's pears, whether it's watermelons, whether it's corn, wheat, nursery products, those go not only here in Oregon and not only across the country, but they go around the world. Oregon is a global producer, and often if you hear about agricultural water use, it's important to remember that that water use, while it's used on the field and it's conveyed through a canal, that it goes to produce commodities that are consumed by all of us and benefiting all of us. However, the canals, pipelines, ditches, reservoir systems, different infrastructure, was often built in a period long ago, in the early 1900s, which I realize maybe wasn't that long ago, but before all of us that are here today. And it was done in a period of unprecedented federal investment in our infrastructure nationally. Roads, bridges, but also canals, reservoirs, and all those different things. That federal infrastructure investment has largely dried up. However, these facilities still remain, and they still provide the benefits that they were intended to provide, which includes not only water supply for agriculture, but also flood control to protect communities and other important areas. Also, hydropower is generated from some of these facilities, and all of those things are still important benefits. But now this infrastructure is crumbling, and it's important to make sure that not only it continues into the future, but that it has improvements to address fish passage, water quality, and different important things of that nature. So as I mentioned, the sources of water could be a river, it could be a pond, it could be a large reservoir. So the picture here on the left, that's of the Owyhee Dam, which is in Representative Mintz. I won't say that it's in his direct backyard, but it's as close to his backyard than most. That is Oregon's largest dam. And I will say that's a Bureau of Reclamation facility. It was built in the late 1930s. And since there are often questions about the status of reservoirs on some folks' mind, I will say that this facility, while it is old, it's in remarkably good condition. You can actually take tours to go into the bottom of the dam and see how well built it was. And thankfully, it was well built, because if it wasn't, there's a whole lot of water that's back there that could come rushing down. And we certainly wouldn't want that. But that is what most people think of when they think of dams. And that actually is not what most of Oregon's facilities look like that serve agriculture. They're more likely to look at the picture on the right. And this is just an example of some of those additional improvements that need to be made to infrastructure. So the one on the left is of a fish ladder that's being constructed in the Deschutes. And over on the right is a fish screen. It's actually the farmer's fish screen. And I show those to you to illustrate that fish passage, fish screening, when I first started, I thought a screen, you must just slap that up on the backside of a pipe and that's how you keep the fish out. Well, they're actually very elaborate structures that take a large footprint and a lot of engineering to make sure that they're done right so that fish can safely traverse those various obstacles. And so while the federal investment has dried up for a lot of these infrastructure, the needs remain very much so. And our members have been successful at using the existing federal funding that's there, such as Bureau of Reclamation's Water Smart program, the Clean Water State Revolving Loan Fund that DEQ administers, and funding through the NRCS program that allows for districts to work with farmers and other interests on cost share programs to improve their infrastructure. However, that funding needs adequate state funding to match with that. And at the state level, we have some funding sources, such as the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board's funding programs. The Water Resources Department funding currently has feasibility and also has some implementation funding and some small amounts of planning. However, the need for all of these different issues that we've talked about is far greater than all of those funds combined. And we want to ensure that agriculture continues to be vibrant and thriving and modernizes itself into the future. And so we do have some work to do in that regard. And I won't steal the thunder from my other colleagues that are going to follow, but there's great opportunities ahead of us for innovating and doing things differently. However, the key thing for my members and for the water users that they serve and the water users who ultimately pay for the delivery of this water is it has to pencil out, and it has to be in a way that works for all folks that are involved. And so I was at a conference here last week recently, and they talked about different ways that you can motivate folks. And I understand that philosophically sometimes folks will just have a difference of opinion. But for me, if you're faced with having a carrot or having a stick, the carrot seems to work a lot better in many ways. And that is to say, having incentives to do more than what you have to within a regulatory structure that limits what you can and cannot do is the best that we can do with that. And that is to say, within Oregon, we have a very robust system of water law that very much protects the user and the state. The water belongs to the state. However, we're really lacking the infrastructure and the additional incentives to get people to do more than what they have to. So there are a variety of issues that you guys are going to talk about this session, whether it's related to fees and how water users pay into that system, or whether it's related to measurement and how folks pay for that, or what ways they use those different apparatuses and how the data they use comes out of that. But ultimately, we're all in this together. We all want to eat. We all want to have fresh drinking water and have the wonderful environment that we live in. And to do that, it's going to take all of us to come up with the right mechanisms, the right incentives, and a mix of funding with regulations to ensure that we're all here. Hopefully, well, not to say that we're all here, but these systems and the structures that we're creating are here 50, 100 years into the future, and that we're able to say that we contributed positively to Oregon's water supply future. But for the perspective of Oregon's irrigated ag, we are being creative, we are being innovative, and we're looking forward to working with a great number of folks to help modernize our systems and do many more things into the future. So with that, I think I will, I guess we'll pause and see if you guys have any questions and then switch it over to.
Thanks, April. I think what I'd like to do, committee, is to let the panel go ahead and finish up and then ask questions of the panel at the end. So whoever's next can go ahead.
Hello, excuse me. Hello, Chair Helm and committee. Thank you for letting me be here to speak. My name is Julie Davies O'Shea. I'm the Executive Director of Farmers Conservation Alliance, and I'm here today to talk about the benefits of irrigation modernization, as these projects are truly one of the greatest opportunities for agricultural security, agricultural production, environmental benefits, community benefits, and benefits in our rural areas. FCA got its start back in 2006, and it got its start because of a fish screen technology that April just recently showed. It was invented by the Farmers Irrigation District in Hood River, and we created FCA in order to take that screen to market. And so we spent the next 8 years working on getting a federal approval for our technology. And during this time, we traveled throughout the Western United States, meeting with irrigators, working with agencies, working with nonprofits, and having conversations about how we could improve infrastructure as well as get fish screens in the ground. To give you a sense of scale of this issue, 75 to 80% of the water that is diverted is for irrigated agriculture. In Oregon alone, we have 70,000 diversions. In the Western United States, there is roughly 1 million diversions. So it's a big number, and it's a potential for significant impact. As I said, we were traveling around and working on how we could get some fish screens in the ground. In 2011, we were very fortunate to become the first organization to get our fish screen technology approved by National Marine Fisheries Service so we could start selling our screen on a more broad basis. It was really exciting for us, and we went back out to all these irrigators we had met and started putting a number of screens in the ground. But along the way, we kept finding places where we had wanted to put a screen in the ground, the irrigators wanted to put a screen in, but because the infrastructure was so old, there was a number of barriers to actually implementing the technology. And we kept having this conversation not only with the irrigators, but we would work with state and federal agencies and talk to them about how they were working to deploy programs, innovative solutions, and were struggling with the same issues. Again, with nonprofit partners, we kept having these conversations about how do we bring modern pieces of technology and put them into systems that are 75 to 125 years old. It's challenging. One of the partners we worked pretty extensively with on this discussion was Energy Trust of Oregon, as they were working to deploy in-conduit hydropower in trying to figure out ways we would be able to get more in-conduit projects in. Because on all those diversions we talked about that's moving water for irrigated agriculture, you have an opportunity to be able to put hydro on those systems. And just like the fish screens and just like a number of the water quality programs and other infrastructure programs we had seen, it was really difficult to be able to actually deploy that program because of the barriers that were out there. And we started having a conversation about how do we start addressing this issue of modernizing irrigation infrastructure that really has one of the greatest potentials in the Western United States for agriculture and for the environment. How can we start accelerating this? So we looked around at systems that had modernized and talked with the people who had led those few projects that had gone all the way through modernization and started having a conversation about how can we take what they did over a 30-year period and try to figure out how to do it over a 10-year period? And how can we build out a program that can take the lessons learned and that knowledge that's built up in those districts and the information and transfer it and support it to other irrigation districts or groups of irrigators where there's limited resources and limited support to actually help navigate that process? And so with Energy Trust of Oregon, we launched the Irrigation Modernization Program about 2.5 years ago. And the idea being that we would work with irrigation districts, help build out modernization strategies, and then by working with a collective of districts, we could talk about this scale of impact as opposed to the one district working to modernize and needing $10 to $100 million. We could have a conversation about what it means across the board. Since we started the program, we had 12 districts instantly sign up, and we're currently pending with another 10. We're currently on track to work with more than 50% of irrigated ag within the next 3 years. And now we're starting to get to the point where we can look at what are those benefits, how much water can go in stream, how much water can be more reliably diverted to agriculture, how can we reduce operation and maintenance costs, how can we increase energy production, yet at the same time dramatically reduce energy use and create more reliable systems. To give an example of what we're working towards, I thought it'd be more interesting to listen to the video of the Lone Pine irrigators talk about it rather than hearing me to continue talk today.
Everybody's got an interest in the water. And water is a finite source, right? So we have to learn how to share this water. And I think the farmers want to do that. I think all the irrigation districts and the farmers want to do that. But they also want to protect their economic livelihood. Well, that's really important. And here in Lone Pine, our economic livelihood, 95% of our irrigation water is used to grow crops and production for the farmer. So, well, we have to be able to collaborate with everybody and make this all work as a group goal for all of Deschutes Basin. We have about 7 miles of open irrigation canal. There's a certain amount of water leakage through the canals, or we have open canals. We get evaporation. So we've got a really good irrigated valley out here, but one of the things that happens in transporting that water to the irrigators is the loss of water. And if we could pipe and have pressurized pipe, we could reduce our costs to our farmers, our costs to our district. We'd be able to return that conserved water back to the river and to the reservoirs, which will help the fish and the frogs. So, you know, piping our district is number one in our future goals.
These open ditches are, they were fine years ago when we had a lot of water, but as the population grows, so does the demand on what water there is available. And with all the miles of open ditches that it takes to get water delivered out to Lone Pine, there's just a lot of evaporation and a lot of leaks.
I'm four generations, so it's kind of a cultural threat to me. My family's been in ranching for four generations, so I'd hate to lose that. I'm hoping that we can solve these problems, but that's our biggest issue, I think, is trying to be able to do what we do while being conscientious of those around us.
I think certainly piping will be our future. We have a certain amount of loss with our open ditches, and when you look at some of the land here with the lava, the water seepages can be pretty high. So certainly piping will be a huge benefit for our district and conserving the water for agriculture.
This is a flume that's still in use. It's probably been here around 50 years when the district started putting water in the upper elevations of the district. While some of these systems may be somewhat antiquated, they came with the land and it's been in place for a long time. Our operation is trying to react to that and figure out how to be progressive and hold down to everything that we can while being conscientious of the environment that we farm in and the area that we farm in.
I think a lot of it will be the delivery systems, how we get water out of the Deschutes River and delivered to these irrigation districts, and piping's the answer. It's the maintenance on a lot of these districts is so terrific with these open canals, and once you put it in a pipe, you're basically just solve that problem.
With a pressurized system, they'll be able to tap right into the water and be able to irrigate their places without having to run pumps, without having to do maintenance costs, without having to, you know, maintaining their laterals and their ponds. It's going to be huge savings.
The challenge is we're a small district. There's only about 2,400 irrigated acres here. So we don't have the capabilities of generating a lot of money to help with these improvement projects. So that's, I think, is one of the biggest challenges, is the financing of the modernization.
Some organizations have actually supported the irrigation district's efforts to modernize and to get a pressurized piping system in place, simply because if we conserve water, then they can benefit too for their fishing and their trout. And, you know, like you take the Warm Springs tribe, they benefit because they're looking at the Chinook salmon and the steelhead, and that's going to benefit greatly from us conserving water.
I think the biggest thing is for each entity that has a need for water, we all need to work together. We need, as farmers, to learn what the city needs. The city needs to learn what the farmers need. And it's just an education process. Now there's going to be so much pressure on what water is available that everybody's got to work together, or there's not going to be enough water for anybody.
I think as we modernize, and if we can do piping, the conservation of the water will allow stream flow levels to go up. That will help the Endangered Species Act, as well as provide us with adequate water for agriculture. And instead of being opposing each other, we can work together to get those solutions.
So wrapping up from the video, as I said, we're working with 12 districts now. We have another 10 districts that are coming into the program. And it's been a really incredible experience for these last 2 years to be going all the way from Baker City to the Rogue to the Klamath to the Deschutes, Hood River, working with irrigators, and yet hearing the same words and excitement that we see when we're sitting in San Francisco at funders' offices to Washington, D.C., and seeing that energy of how much modernizing these systems can benefit. We're very privileged to be in a state where we have such great partners such as the OWRC, Energy Trust, being able to work with OWRD, with OWEB, as well as with DEQ and the CWSRF funds. It's been a real privilege, and we're very excited to see where this goes. We encourage support for modernizing this infrastructure. Thank you for your time.
Chair Helm, Vice Chairs Johnson and Power, J.R. Cook, representing the Northeast Oregon Water Association, and I'm here today, I think, to talk a little bit about the unique opportunities that there are to, once we get beyond these assessments on how we modernize irrigation, to actually how we fund them, getting from place-based planning, which is kind of the hot button topic, you know, doing these plans, assessing what we can fix and how much it's going to cost. But what we, as you saw in the video, really need to take a look at is how various funding sources can be utilized and leveraged to get the projects to actually pencil and actually take place. As you all know, our basin, we've been planning. I've been involved in the Umatilla Basin for 15 years. I'm a rookie in this effort. We've been working on it for over 30 years, trying to figure out a way to sustainably access the Columbia River and fix our problem. You folks really gave us a big shot in the arm in 2015, and there's a one-pager that kind of shows you the status of what we call our first biennium effort, which is to get first of their kind, unprecedented mitigation Columbia River rights through negotiations with the environmental groups that we work with, and also to get what we call our arteries, our pipelines, down into the critical groundwater areas that opens up a significant land base that has been cut off from water supplies since the ESA issues in the 80s and our critical groundwater areas designations in the 70s and 80s. So we're at the first stage of that, and do you want me to move that around? I should show you this. So we talk about fish screens. So that upper right-hand corner picture, that's the fish screens we use. That's kind of shows you the difference in scale of Columbia River irrigation versus some of the tributary irrigation that you've seen in April's, which really kind of shows the you know, kind of the diversity of the state of Oregon and how the one-size-fits-all plan really doesn't fit in this state, because we are very diverse as it relates to our water use and ultimately what we gain from it. So this is in your packet, kind of shows you what our short and long term goals are. There's been five plans. The most recent was the Columbia River Umatilla Solutions Task Force that was appointed by Governor John Kitzhaber back in 2010. That kind of said, okay, the whole argument of any water is good water for ag and fish isn't working anymore. What problems are we trying to fix, and what solutions are out there, and how much is it going to cost? And we were really able to narrow that down and find our local definition of success, which is what we're working on now. Go ahead and go to the next one. So getting back to our first biennium, that was the 2015 to now, which was working on water rights that have been very, very hard to negotiate. And I'll tell you why. The state of Oregon has what are called Division 33 rules. And what they tell you is that above Bonneville Dam, during the period of April 15th to October 1st, you shall mitigate bucket for bucket. But that's as far as it goes. It doesn't say what qualifies as mitigation, just says do no harm. And so trying to bring water development groups, environmental groups together to agree to what does no harm is next to impossible in the state of Oregon, right? So it's been one of those things where it's been a very delicate negotiation to put some sideboards on these temporary water rights to say, okay, here's how we're going to develop the river now, but what is it going to lead to in the future? And so the second biennium, which is where we're at now as these projects are being built, is to look at ways we can find permanent mitigation in the upper Columbia River system. Who's going to pay for it, and how do we get access to those mitigation credits down in our region, which brings potential for these partnerships together with the FCA and with these irrigation modernization. Our basin's been very involved with the Freshwater Trust for a significant number of years, trying to figure this exact same thing out. And so here it is. I mean, those are the three regional pipelines. Two of the three are funded right now under the House Bill 5030 bond that will be sold in July. $11 million is coming to our base, and it's leveraging $60 million in private investment in our region. So there's a lot of skin in the game from our farmers. But that's a 30-year temporary mitigation water right. And within that 30-year period, we have to find water under a permanent program to backfill these temporary mitigation supplies we've negotiated with the groups we work with. But what this picture really shows you is that with some creative thinking, it opens up 200,000 acres of customer base of farmers that need to buy permanent mitigation at some point in the time. And so you have FCA that's wanting to do some assessments and look at ways we can modernize infrastructure. We know the plus one of modernizing infrastructure is going to be to these smaller regions and their bottom line, but also to fish benefit. But at the end of the day, our customer base brings a matching group into the equation that the state doesn't have to spend as much on those projects to get the modernization done. If we can have access to the river for a mitigation credit, our users are glad to help cost share those upstream modernization projects. So huge customer base sitting here ready to partner on these modernization projects when and if we get access via a permanent mitigation program that's yet to be developed in the state of Oregon. But also it just shows you ways that private dollars can come in with the conservation dollars and with state dollars, excuse me, as I talk a lot with my hands, to truly provide for enough resources to where not one individual benefit is paying the whole cost of the project. As we've really seen, there's great projects out there. I mean, these aren't going to be surprises when they come to you and you see what the benefits are. But what always is the sticker shock is how much is it going to cost? And I always say this, fish and farms write the smallest checks of the whole value chain in the state of Oregon. So pinning all the costs on fish, or the folks that want to help the fish, and pinning all the costs on ag, which starts the value chain but needs water at a certain cost to be able to grow the crop, you're never going to get the project done. If we can bring the two together with some state and federal help, then we've got leverage dollars and match dollars that can partner, and we get multiple use of the same molecule for both conservation and environmental benefit and for furthering our economic benefits and economic output in the state of Oregon. So that's really all I came to say was you've got a willing partner in the Umatilla Basin to do this work. When and if it gets to the implementation stage, we look forward to seeing some of the reports that come out of FCA's work upstream from us. So thanks for having me.
Great. Thank you for being here, JR, and all of you. Questions from the committee? Representative Holvey.
Thanks. I guess my question's for Mr. Cook. I sort of remember this conversation a while back in the governor's office and talking about the Umatilla Water District and what they were trying to do. I applaud the efforts you've made. But I'm trying to remember. It seems like I also heard a discussion about trying to integrate some off-channel water storage as well as a piece of this. I didn't
go back to
I was kind of looking for it in this description. I must have missed it.
That last infrastructure slide.
And what was what's the status of that proposal?
Great question, Chair Helm, Representative Holby. So the map that's up on the screen, so the first in this whole phase of this is, again, a multi-biennium effort. So the first phase is getting the direct supply pipelines using these temporary mitigation water rights down into the critical groundwater areas. Those pipelines are only used for the irrigation season. So there's a significant amount of capacity sitting there in the off season to do just what you explained, off-channel storage. So if you look at our central, the pipeline right in the middle, and you'll see what we call the blue whale. I think the Deschutes has their white whale. We have a blue whale. That shows an optimization scenario of using that pipeline in the off season to recharge the ordinance alluvial aquifer. And to just show you how much we actually got use out of the $2.5 million you gave us in 2009 under 3369, we did a significant amount of data acquisition to see what that aquifer does and how it responds to recharge. The problem was we were using the pipeline that supplied the Boardman Tree Farms on the left of your screen, and that was a pressurized system, and so it was very expensive water because you're boosting Columbia River water all the way to recharge. So it was $72 an acre foot water just to get it into the ground. And then you had to pay to pump it out and send it somewhere. But what we were able to find was that that aquifer can hold quite a bit of water. The central project has about 18,000 acre feet of delivery capacity sitting there that we're not using when we get it built, that's not being used in the irrigation season. And that water with regen, with because we pick up 60 pounds of pressure once we get over the hill, we can regenerate electricity and put that water in the ground, and that's around $13 to $20 an acre foot. So we're finding ways to decrease the cost of off-channel winter storage, but that's going to be the second phase of optimizing these new pipelines once we get them in the ground. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. Thanks.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. Julie, thanks for your report. Really like what you're talking about. Tell me more about the ETO support for these efforts, and is that only limited to the IOUs? Jurisdiction, Pacific Corp and PGE.
So with Energy Trust, we work with districts that are currently in Energy Trust territory or have the potential to wheel power to Energy Trust territory. So that is the criteria of which we can bring districts in. So you will see that we're working with some districts that are in their traditional space, as well as working with districts that are outside but have the potential to bring energy in, which is why we're so broad across the state of Oregon.
Okay, good. Just to follow up then.
Follow up.
I was talking to Les is going to be up here next to talk to you guys. I was talking about to him this morning, but I really, as we talk about community renewables and so forth, you know, I'm really looking for ways that we can incentivize these type of renewable projects and begin to delineate between windmills in certain parts of the state and some of these other renewable projects that have all kinds of other ancillary benefits to them. So. Mm-hmm. I'll just throw that out, and I'd love to get an appointment with you sometime soon.
That would be great.
Thanks.
Further questions, committee? Julie, just before we go, that flume we're looking at in Lone Pine, that's really, we're looking at a piece of history, aren't we? There aren't a ton of those left, and there's a reason for that. Can you briefly just describe the financial battle that irrigation district, and April, maybe you can chime in too, is facing in trying to modernize?
Well, I know in the case of Lone Pine, and we see this pretty consistently across the board, regardless of where we are, is we have these canals that are currently leaking anywhere from 30% to 60% of the water. And then you see pressures for delivery, for water reliability, pressures of operation and maintenance, because the district themselves have to pay to be able to move that water, which comes through pumping cost. Mm-hmm. So their pumping costs are very high. Their operation and maintenance costs are really high. And yet at the same time, especially places like in the Deschutes, where we have pressures of the Endangered Species Act and the spotted frog, we're looking at ways to get more water in stream. And these canals are one of the best ways that you could possibly do that. It is a pretty extraordinary benefit across the board. The challenge is when you're looking at a district like Lone Pine, you have, I know I'm going to get the exact number wrong, but roughly 17 irrigators with that system, and we're currently working with them to pencil out what that cost is. But let's say for the sake of this conversation, it's going to be $12 million. Will 17 family farms be able to pay that type of cost? They won't be able to. And yet the benefits are so immense for the community at large, and the potential for energy conservation and renewable generation is so significant. That is part why we're building out this modernization strategy, is to not only look at what they need from an irrigation perspective, but also to look at how we can communicate and connect with other partners and find those win-win scenarios to help accelerate work.
Thank you.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, just to add on to that, agree with everything that Julie just said, and Lone Pine is just a snapshot of different districts, and so the way that districts work is it's the patrons, the water users within the district who pay for the delivery of the water. They're not paying for the water, they're paying for the maintenance of that system. And so if you have a district like Lone Pine that only has 17 and has to pay $12 million, or you have a district that has 100 patrons but has to pay, you know, $50 million, the quandary is the same, in that you have to spread that burden. Also, if you want to take out a loan, you have to take that to a vote of your patrons. And just like with a city or any other government, folks aren't very keen to pay more money, especially when it's not going to necessarily yield them more water immediately. So you have to tell the story and show them how it's going to be beneficial, which, as Julie mentioned, there's a lot of forces for why you want to pipe an open canal or put in conservation efficiency or storage projects. But on the flip side, there are also challenges to that in that there are currently some folks who are trying to prevent piping of open canals because they see it as their scenic water feature, and they have taken efforts to declare sections historic, which in some instances, yes, there are some very historic structures. However, there are some choices, I think, that need to be made as to what is the value of the water that's going to be conserved versus the pretty old thing that's sitting there that used to convey it. And that is something that, in particular, the districts in the Deschutes are working through. They're trying to identify the most historic areas, find ways to preserve those or take sections and put it in a museum while still continuing to practice conservation and efficiency. However, the bigger the districts, you have more folks and more folks that you have to get their opinions. And if there are areas that have urbanization around them, then the folks in the cities aren't paying into the district, yet they would like to have some say-so into how that district pipes its canals or doesn't pipe its canals, and so it complicates it. But it's a very important issue to think about. If you have those individual farmers that are faced with that choice, and because we do live in a democracy and in a capitalist society, you can always change what you're doing and do something differently. And so if it becomes too burdensome, that's what happens, is folks will walk away and do something else, which is why it's so important to be embarking upon the partnerships that you've heard from today, where we can find a better way to hopefully keep the good things and improve them and move forward. So, thank you.
Representative Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's really interesting to listen to these discussions of the transition from a systems that were hugely beneficial because of the waste of water to all kinds of good things environmentally toward systems that are much more measured, much more piped, much more industrial. And that's what we see going on up in and around Hermiston. We're turning that into an industrial region as opposed to one that used to be a lot, not unlike the Lone Pine one we just saw. And what we're seeing because of these pressures to transition is a move away from systems that were very beneficial to a lot of wildlife, a lot of other values that are going to disappear. And what you see are pivots and very, very squared up fields and a lot of plastic and stuff like that, which didn't used to be the case. It's interesting because you never can get a measure of it. So I'm just saying, as I watched this transition for 40 years, that's why it's working up in JR's region. That's why, because A, lots of water; B, lots of money; C, high priced crops; D, industrialization of farming. Mm-hmm. Same time, it's hugely interesting because we'll hear all kinds of bills, I'm sure, perhaps in this committee, about how wonderful the family farm is. But at the same time, we're helping transition to something far greater than that, I guess. Just saying.
That was an interesting question, Representative.
That was a great question. And there is a question mark at the end of it, because I wonder, as we listen to this explanation of the transition, if it's all for the best. Because we're going to hear a lot about measurement and other things here soon. And I just want to point out where that type of specificity leads.
Thank you.
Appreciate the opportunity to ask that long question.
Thank you. Any further
why are we
questions?
We're rants.
Okay. One last question, then we want to get to the next.
Oh, it's a real.
You're going to have a similar type question. Probably.
No, mine's actually a question. My question is for April, I guess, or anybody. I'm just curious. I mean, we talked a lot about that. Do we, you know, is there any issues in Western Oregon around these same subjects?
Chair Helm, members of the committee, Representative Holvey, yes, even in the glorious wet side, we have a lot of issues, actually, with water supply management. And a colleague of mine had once said that we don't have a water supply problem. We have a water supply management problem. And I think that's really clear on days like today, where you have a lot of rain, but then in the summertime, we may have droughts, and we don't necessarily have the different ways on the west side to adequately store that water and use it in an environmentally sustainable manner in the summertime. There are 13 Army Corps dams here in the Willamette that are currently going through a reallocation process, in short, to look at finding a way to ensure that there's water that's stored behind those dams that also has a flood control capacity, to make sure that there's water for agriculture while ensuring that the biological needs of endangered fish are met through the biological opinion, and then also seeing if there's a way for our municipal brethren to have a small slice of that storage to feed their industrial needs in the valley. And that's one of the few areas of the state where there's still water that could potentially be allocated. But we also have similar issues with districts here needing to pipe open canals and improve the infrastructure so that we have water when we want it and not so much when we don't want it.
Thank you. So it is a statewide issue.
Right.
Julie, go ahead.
Representative Helm, Representative Holvey and committee. We have been getting considerable interest from the districts on the western side as well, because they're really struggling with issues. Though they have a bit more water, it's those operation and maintenance issues, it's the energy issues, and yet it's the potential to be able to look at it from a holistic system, where there's a lot. The approach typically is a one-off approach, where you do one piece, like the fish screen or the hydro. And so it's a really great opportunity to look at energy conservation, generation, as well as water efficiency, and then as well as habitat, as April mentioned.
My apologies. One last note is that groundwater is also a concern on the west side as well as on the east side. I'm not a hydrologist, but the way I look at it is there's different little pockets, and depending on the area of the state, your pocket of water may be easy to reach or it may be harder to reach. And just outside of this area, there are farmers who are going to have to find another source of water. And some are trying to build a storage project because their groundwater, their levels are declining in a way that's no longer sustainable. And so that is an issue statewide. Thank you for the question.
Well, thank you all three once again for traveling. April, you didn't travel far, but Julie and JR, thank you for traveling.
Thank
we
you.
Really appreciate your testimony today.
Thanks for having us. I just want the record to show that for the first time in my career, I talk least on the whole panel.
And Les and Mike, come on up, please. I'll extend my same thanks to both of you for traveling today. You ended up doing it a lot, aren't you, Les?
Yes. Chair Helm, committee, I thank you for having me today, and I promise I'll be brief because I was just here talking about this topic not very long ago. And so I think my role today is, first, I'm manager of Farmers Irrigation District, Hood River County Commissioner, and recovering Farmers Conservation Alliance staff member. I was able to work all around the West in irrigation systems with FCA, and then I've been fortunate to really focus on water resources in our basin, in Hood River Basin.
Les, I need you to get your full name on this.
Oh, sorry. Les Perkins.
Yeah, sorry. Sorry to interrupt.
I've been fortunate to work in our basin as a county commissioner working on water resource issues, but then to have it's been about 15 months now, to manage an irrigation district with hydropower, and that's gone through most of the things that you heard about today. Our district has been through. So over the last 30 years, we've modernized our system. And so we had flumes, just like you saw in that video. Actually, just when I started working with FCA, I believe it was late 2005, early 2006, an earthquake took down the last flumes that Farmers Irrigation District had, and basically took out their infrastructure and caused them to have to put pumps in the river and pump while they put new pipe in the ground. So we've been able to experience most of those pieces of modernization over the years, and it was a painful process for us, primarily because we didn't really plan well. Jerry Bryan, who was the manager 30 years ago, embarked on this process without really having a roadmap to follow, and did a lot of things right, did a lot of things the difficult way. And so this irrigation modernization program really provides an opportunity to do it right from the start. And so all of the funding opportunities that were discussed earlier, Farmers has used. So we've used OWEB funds. We've used Bureau Reclamation funds. We've used funds from Oregon Water Resources Department and CWSRF funds. The important thing for our district was having the in-conduit hydropower. And so I know I beat this drum a lot, but it is the aspect of our system that's allowed us to modernize. And it's the $50 million in revenue over 30 years that we have used to leverage a lot more funds than that to build our system out. And it's given us the opportunity to be competitive when it comes to grant funding and any other funding. So we're able to take that revenue that we have and put it into our system and then leverage the other funds. We're able to take on debt where districts that don't have hydro, it's very difficult to take on 20 years worth of debt if you don't have that income. And so for most districts, just like Lone Pine, the landowners can't afford to pay for that themselves. Our district, about a third of our revenue comes from our ratepayers, and that pays purely for our operation and maintenance costs. The other two-thirds of our revenue comes from hydro, and that goes 100% to debt service. So without that hydro, we could not be where we are today. And if you just look around the state at the districts that have modernized, they're districts that have a secondary income source that can be used to leverage. So with that, I will stop and let Mike talk.
Thank you, Chairman Helm and committee, for the opportunity to participate today. My name is Mike Tripp. I live in Bend. Since retirement, my interest in fly fishing has gotten me into the water problems in a variety of ways. My primary association is with the Deschutes Chapter of Trout Unlimited. And as you probably know, Trout Unlimited is a nonprofit organization with conservation directed towards restoration of cold water fisheries. In the Deschutes Basin, over the past decade, there have been multiple studies done looking at water challenges and management issues. Much was learned from these studies. And while diversions go to agriculture to the extent of 90 or 90-plus percent of the water diverted, scenarios were developed that showed within the basin that there was enough water to meet city and in-stream environmental needs as well as ag with proper projects and conservation. But this work showed everyone that the projects were very complex and didn't have a simple pathway to completion. A consensus was then reached that further study was needed. And there were people that said, you got to be kidding. We don't need more studies on the Deschutes Basin. But, in fact, more studies were needed. Currently, we're entering the third year of a basin study funded by Reclamation and OWRD. This is an interesting process. To do this, we formed an ad hoc group called the Basin Study Work Group, which by charter is a consensus-based organization. We have over 30 voting members on the panel, and at the recent meeting, we had probably another 30 stakeholders that were there attending the meetings. So these meetings, you would think, would be impossible. But impressively, things have gone smoothly, and I think that's a testament to the commitment to collaborative action within Deschutes Basin stakeholders. It's really amazing to see such large groups actually function reasonably efficiently. As this was getting going, the irrigation districts appropriately said, well, we're not going to commit to big new projects until we update our system improvement plans. As they got started with this, we found a nexus with Farmers Conservation Alliance. They brought in an energy trust grant, and their work on developing system improvement projects within the districts is an important complement to the basin study, which is a higher level study of water supply, demand, climate change, and those factors. So as these things are going on, we're now starting to get reports from the many subgroups that have been spun off to tackle specific projects. And so this year is going to be a rich year in terms of actual information. This information base hopefully will provide a starting point for undertaking the real projects to address water issues in the basin. And what we've learned in this process is, as I've alluded to, large majority of stakeholders in the basin are committed to this collaborative process. But we're really facing a lot of complexities. consider that in the upper basin there are nine irrigation districts. You heard about Lone Pine. That's a tiny one. The two big ones are North Unit that diverts about 200,000 acre-feet a year and Central Oregon Irrigation that diverts about 300,000 acre-feet a year. North Unit in Jefferson County is the major commercially successful ag district of all those irrigation districts. Central Oregon Irrigation has a few commercial irrigators, but has a large number of lifestyle irrigators that are very small acreage, subdivided previous larger tracts, which have a very different outlook on their water use and motives for what they do on their land. Along with this, we have five major reservoirs, three of which are reclamation with all of those restrictions. And for every piece of river or irrigation district that we look at in terms of projects, there are really an amazingly long list of regulations, state, federal, and otherwise, that come into play when solutions and possible projects are discussed. Politics and culture, as well as engineering, are issues. And realizing that I was told to keep this to a couple of minutes, I'm going to jump to an example of what people have called the last worst case in the Deschutes Basin. First, I would note that we have made progress on the Middle Deschutes, Weiches Creek, Tumalo Creek in terms of restoring in-stream flows. But the Upper Deschutes, historically since the late 1940s after WICCIP went into function, was periodically run down to 20 cubic feet per second in the winter from the historical levels of about 800. Recently, with the ESA listing of the Oregon spotted frog, pressure has accelerated to fix that upper river. It historically was considered one of the prized blue ribbon fisheries in the state. It now has essentially no recreational fishing because of the devastation from those low winter flows. With the frog lawsuits of last year, a temporary settlement was reached to increase these winter flows to a minimum of 100 CFS. And habitat projections suggest that the Habitat Conservation Plan may call for eventually increasing winter flows to 500 to 600 cubic feet per second. That's a lot of water to move from the irrigation districts into the river. So to accommodate that, really a variety of things, a suite of projects and scenarios are going to have to be developed. And they're going to be complicated both by economics as well as legal, political, cultural obstacles to accomplish that. Some of the ways of getting water in stream are relatively low cost, such as leasing or on-farm efficiencies. But in our districts, the irrigation districts, particularly Central Oregon Irrigation, tells us that they really can't implement those low-cost options to any extent until they handle their archaic and inefficient primary canal distribution system, which is very leaky, as you've heard. So work has been developed to the point of having some system improvement plan information on that. It looks like the cost of these main canal pipes are going to run to be more than $1 million per single cubic foot per second restoration of in-stream flows. So the total cost of the Upper Deschutes in that project is looking at hundreds of millions of dollars. It's kind of staggering. And so the question is that even realistic? Well, I think I and the environmental community do support that, because I think you can make arguments that the return on that investment is not just for the irrigators, it's for the Central Oregon economy in general, both immediate infrastructure investment and economic activity from that, and restoration of a blue ribbon fishery in the upper river. But to accomplish that, funding is obviously the big problem. Hydropower is potentially an issue. In these system improvement plans, there are spots where potential piped canals can be turned into some hydropower for potentially helping with financing. But it looks like that won't cover much of the cost. It's my belief that to support this type of investment, general public support is needed. And the general public needs to see a return on the investment. It can't be overly focused on the irrigation districts alone. And in my way of looking at this, modernization of irrigation is much more than simply infrastructure development. It is really, should be, the goal should be that we put this in the context of developing a basin-wide water management strategy that satisfies cities, the environment, and irrigators. And it can be done if we have the ability to maintain a collaborative, functional approach to the problem. So thank you again for
Thank you.
Comment.
Committee questions? Very good. I guess we're all questioned out. Representative Bentz's last question wore us down.
Oh, there you go. I'll ask a shorter one, Mr. Chair. So is the word strategy, I always find that of interest because that suggested that the current water rights system isn't working and we need a new strategy to adjust those who have water rights so that those who don't have more of the water. And so what I've seen is this long-term battle where those that have the water rights are engaged in this kind of a push-pull that you've just explained. And you say we need a long-term strategy, and I see this in the audit we're about to discuss. It's a rather broad general term, but the reality is never really brought out. So perhaps you can say what you mean by strategy.
Representative Bentz, it is complicated. There are a lot of details and nuanced issues related to that, and I didn't feel I had the time to go into that. But when we look at the structural infrastructure projects that we can do within the different districts, we need to realize that the main benefit for agriculture economically is going to be North Unit with its junior rights. If we conserve water in another district, we have to somehow shift that water to that district, and at the same time shift water within the river to satisfy environmental laws such as the ESA for the frog. So to do that, we have actually looked at scenarios where we have to do things that are not permitted under current law. And so there are issues about potentially needing to address water law, some of the issues of the Water Conservation Act of Oregon, those types of restrictions that may need modification as we look at accomplishing these things. And so I would perhaps make the plea that I hope all of you support funding for the key state agencies that address these issues, OWRD, ODFNW, ODA, Soil and Water Conservation Districts, DEQ. They're all understaffed and underfunded in our basin. We need their help, but they need help to staff up and be able to tackle these challenges. So there are issues of water law. People are working on ways to work around that. But as you know, if you deviate from the standard, you may well face litigation and other challenges. So that's why it's so important to maintain this broad coalition working in a transparent way to make it clear that the stakeholders of the Deschutes Basin believe this is the right thing to do.
Follow very, very short. So I just say to thank you for that answer. I think it's well informed, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Les, did you want to chime in there?
I was just going to say, in our basin, we've used pretty much every tool in the toolbox when it comes to water rights. And yes, we could use more tools, but we've been able to accomplish a lot in our basin with the tools that are there. And we're being creative with looking at how we address things in the future. We're creating a water bank within our basin where we can fund the lands that we have that are in annual crops. We can actually pay the landowners to not irrigate in drought years, and we're doing that within our own basin. And so there's tools like that, and the Deschutes has done a lot more in the water banking and trading.
And the basin has done those things. It's complicated by the fact that we have three different rivers that are all different in terms of geology and hydrology, and nine districts that for 100 years operated independently and only have started to operate cooperatively through the Deschutes Basin Board of Control in the last couple of years. So it's been a little harder. It's not just one district and one river. It's a nice thing that farmers have. We do have an analogy, one district and one river, and that's the Three Sisters Irrigation in Wychus. And that simplifies things so much, they are almost fully piped now. So when you simplify some of those other issues, you can move much quicker.
And the planning that the Deschutes is going through now is the planning that our basin did a few years ago, and it is absolutely essential to finding a roadmap to move forward.
Representative Holby, last question.
Thanks. And I have a question that and maybe is a simple question. I've always kind of wondered as I've watched Central Oregon and the Deschutes area grow, and seeing the agricultural land and the pressure of all the development that happens, where there's lots of houses built out in the rural areas that have probably all got permits to dig wells, and it seems like that aquifer is going to impact the amount of water available through your water rights as well. And so how does that...
The Deschutes Basin has a specific management plan for groundwater, the Deschutes Basin Plan, and it lays out a roadmap for regulation of who can acquire new groundwater rights.
Okay.
And you need to mitigate to acquire new groundwater rights. It's a key issue for the cities in particular. For some years, the cities were able to acquire mitigation through urbanized acres, which were then transferred to in-stream water rights that allowed them to acquire the groundwater mitigation right to pump that amount of water, well, actually a little different amount of water from the groundwater. After 2008-09 crash, the districts made a decision that they were no longer going to allow urbanized acres to be used for mitigation, that they were going to try to transfer those within the irrigation districts. And now with the spotted frog and the call for more winter flows in the upper Deschutes, there's an even stronger argument against that, that the irrigators say, we need to give this to North Unit, not mitigation for groundwater. So that's one of the issues. That's one of a long list of issues that's being dealt with in the basin study. How are we going to deal with mitigating to give the cities the groundwater mitigation credits they need? And it's going to take some creativity. It may raise challenges to current legal practices and law interpretation in the state.
Thanks.
Thank you both. Your testimony is most valued, and thanks again for traveling today.
Okay. Thank you.
Appreciate it. At this time, I'm going to invite Jake Madison forward. Hi, Jake. Thank you for traveling and being convinced to be here as well. So
took some work.
Please introduce yourself, and then also for the committee, make sure that, you know, we should have had JR up here to introduce you probably. But maybe you can introduce yourself and provide the history of how you got involved with this type of work.
Sure. Chair Holm, thank you. Vice Chairs, committee, thank you for your time today. My name's Jake Madison. I'm a fourth generation family farm from Echo, Oregon. I'm here to talk to you guys today about irrigation efficiency and management through measurement. So.
Thank you.
So in our basin, you guys heard about Division 33 earlier, and you guys are familiar with that. And so basically what that did is there was a couple tools that farmers could use to get new water rights. The bucket-for-bucket mitigation was discussed earlier. And then conserved water rights was one of the other pieces that we could use to further develop new ground as we were able to save water on conserved water applications. So groundwater right curtailment is one of the things that has forced us to become more efficient. The well on our family farm was shut off in the late 80s. My neighbor's farm was shut off about that same time, and it was just too many holes in the same aquifer, and everybody was using too much water. We didn't have the science to measure it. We knew it was going down. We weren't sure how fast. And then when people's wells started going dry, OWRD and the farmers recognized that there was a problem, and they started shutting off the junior wells first. And so that forced farmers to irrigate as efficiently as possible. I briefly discussed the no additional withdrawals and the conserved water rights already. Operational costs and economics. Electricity's got more expensive, fertilizer's got more expensive. It's a purely an economic thing, and trying to reduce costs has been a major driver in applying new technology to try to become more efficient. Expanding crop rotations. Some of these new acres that are seeing irrigation water for the first time are high value acres for like a potato crop. There's no soil diseases there. There's no history, and then you combine the climate that we have and the soil type that we have. According to Lamb Weston and ConAgra, there's the two best places to grow potatoes in the world is the Columbia Basin and someplace in Iran, or not Iran, by Russia. I'm having a brain fart right now, but anyway, it's a long ways away. And so the Columbia Basin for the processors has a big draw as far as to be able to produce high-quality potatoes when we cool down at night. And so that demand, those processing plants, has created additional demand for potato acres, onion acres, carrots, sweet corn, various organic crops, but all kinds of different crops that we can grow very well. If you guys have questions, you can interrupt me or wait till the end, it doesn't matter. And then consumer demand. And it's not just consumer demand on the physical crop itself. McDonald's has put a lot of pressure on the producers of their French fries to produce the French fries with the few inputs as possible, and that's trickled down to the grower side too. So we are now producing more French fries per se with less gallons of water than we used to be able to, and we'll go into some of those here in a bit. So when I was a kid in the early 90s, we used to irrigate with center pivot irrigation, and we used 11.2 gallons a minute per acre, which was what a full Columbia River water right was allowed at the time. They had overhead impact sprinklers that took 70 pounds of pressure, and they shot water out 14 feet up in the air. And so you got a lot of loss from 14 feet to the ground, and then you had a lot of energy used to generate the pressure to make those sprinklers operate right. And today we've gone to drop nozzles that hang about 4 feet off the ground, and they run about 15 pounds of pressure. So we've been able to drop system pressures and conserve a bunch of energy that way. And they also have started managing droplet size to where we can limit the impact that a droplet has on the ground so that it'll actually go in the ground better versus compacting the ground. And then they can adjust the trajectory of the sprinkler to where it fights the wind better too. So we've been able to get a lot more water into the ground versus just blowing it around. Drag hoses are used on certain crops. So these are literally hoses that drag on the ground. And that pretty much eliminates all wind loss. You still get a little bit of solar evaporation before it gets in the ground, but once you have a plant canopy, you can get to almost 95% efficient on that. And that's that doesn't work for all crops. It works good for perennial, alfalfa, some not so much seed crops, but mint. These are mint here. These are just from our neighbor. So on some crops that are in the same ground for multiple years, it works really well. Doesn't work good for potatoes, doesn't work good for onions. It just drags from plant to plant, spreads diseases and stuff like that. So there is some drawbacks to those as well. Variable rate irrigation. So if you look at, you can't see the mouse, but the second picture from the right or from the left, well, either one, shows the different zones that we can control those zones individually. So that we can adjust them from 100% irrigation down to zero. We can turn them off, we can make them run 20%. And so you'll see on the red image is a aerial infrared that we had a local company take for us, and you can see the really bright spots in that field or spots where we were over irrigating. And so the next map to the right, you'll see the purple and the white. That's where we've reduced the amount of water being applied in those areas so that we told the program that we didn't want full irrigation in that area, and so we were able to reduce irrigation in that area. And then you can see the same thing. The third map from the left, the orange and green one, that's an elevation profile. So you can kind of see there's a low elevation there where that orange goes out to the middle, and you can see where we've adjusted the application right there as well to where the water runs off the hills. You don't have to apply as much in the bottom to get the same effect. And so you can eliminate rotten potatoes, or if you're trying to grow a specialty seed crop, you can get an even consistent crop. So I will say one of the misconceptions about variable rate irrigation is that it saves you water. It kind of does, but on other fields it won't. On other fields it's going to just allow you to apply it in the right spots, better, more efficiently use it. So it might just be taking water from one spot of the field and putting more water on another spot, or it might be using more water in general. But
Jake, what's the interface here? We're seeing screenshots of what?
Yep. So these are from different programs. That the red one is just a Google Earth image, right, with that we've got the infrared picture laid over the top of. And we've had it geo-referenced so that we can set our plot map on top of that with the company. We use Valley Pivots, and they have software that we can write those prescriptions with, and we can do it over the top of that map. And then the third one in, the orange and green one, that's a soil map. That's an EC map that we generated by doing soil testing. And that's, again, just laid on top of Google Earth. And then the fourth one, the blue and purple one, is the same thing from Valley.
Gotcha. Thank you.
So, and pretty much every irrigation company has something similar to this. So it's not just Valley. There's three or four different big pivot manufacturers that have the same technology. Subsurface drip irrigation is about as efficient as you can get. It's very challenging in the fact that it's expensive. It's primarily used in onions because onions are real sensitive to overhead irrigation. You can get a lot of rot issues and stuff like that, and quality goes down. So by using drip, you can use about the same amount of water, but you get 30% increase in yields, and payables are usually still very high. So it's not necessarily, again, a water-saving tool as much as it is an efficiency tool. And it's only good for 1 year. You put it in 1 year, rodents are a pest, right? If you live in a dry, arid area like Hermiston, and there's water in a field somewhere, they'll go dig up the drip line and chew through it, and rodents and predators. So you got to have guys constantly walking the fields, checking for leaks and stuff like that. Otherwise, you end up with a big dry spot in your field, and it's not very good. But better science and tech. So all these, I should have rearranged my slides a little bit, but all these decisions that we've made to go to different styles of irrigation or different types of irrigation has been driven by new technology and new ways to measure the amount of water that we're putting down, measure what the crop needs. And so that's, you know, for weather stations, we've got weather stations at, you know, every corner of the farm. We've got, in the high-value crops, we've got real-time soil moisture probes. You can see, literally see at 4 inches, 8 inches, 12 inches, 20 and 36, and we've got a couple that go clear down to 5 feet just because we were playing with it. But you can literally see the pivot go over the top of that probe and watch it interact at 4 inches, 8 inches, and see the soil, the water work down through the soil profile or not, depending on how much water you were putting down. But so the picture on the bottom left is a picture of a neutron probe site. You can see where the green line, there's 5 different lines there. Those are the different depths of the sensors. The green line on top is the saturation point in the soil capacity. The middle line is right where we're trying to target everything, and then the red line on the bottom is the wilting point of the plant. So that's, I mean, if we get down into the red, we're killing things. So we're trying to keep it between the middle line and the green line, and not push any water down that we don't need. And so that's a good way for us to be able to manage that. And that's something that comes out. It's like $700 a year for that service per field. And they read it once a week. We get a report once a week that shows, you know, what that stuff's doing. We do have, I think I've got a picture of it, but the real-time probe that literally updates every 5 minutes from a cell phone modem, and we can see everything. The second picture from the left is kind of a picture of our big screen TV in our office, and that's got all of our pump stations. You can see all our booster pumps on there, you can see. And so we measure the amount of electricity that each pump's using. We have flow meters on each pump, so we can correlate where they're at, how efficient they're pumping. You know, if one is dropping off the curve and not pumping efficiently, we can go pull it and put it back together and get it back to where it's running as efficiently as it could. And so that's all real-time data. We see that. I can pull that up on my iPad from my hotel room here, from wherever. And so we can make real-time decisions. And the third picture over is basically our big turbine pump at the canal, and that's just kind of showing, you know, how many amps it's pulling, what temperature the drive's running at, so we can constantly monitor everything and detect problems and fix them. The fourth one, too. The fourth one's a separate pump station, but it's got a VFD pump in the middle that will adjust to maintain a set pressure, and we can adjust that target pressure up or down from whatever we need, and it'll remotely slow down or speed up to maintain that pressure. If we shut a circle off, it'll slow way down. If we turn 2 circles on, it'll speed up and then kick the next pump on and speed up again. So this is some of the interfaces that we use to turn pivots on and off on real time. The top left is my cell phone. The bottom left is the other big screen TV at the office that has all the fields on it. And we can click any one of those and pull them up and tell it to start, stop, or see detect a fault. If they have a fault, they'll send us an email, and we can look at them that way. And then the right picture is the weekly report we get from the neutron probes I was telling you guys about. So you can see the red ones are a little bit over-irrigated. Those ones won't come on this week. The yellow ones are getting close, and then the white ones are, well, depending on which one you're looking at. Some of them are really dry, and some of them aren't.
Cool.
So what benefits continue to drive gathering all the information, gathering all the tech that we're doing? It's basically, it's purely economic decision for us, and we feel that you can't make a solid economic decision or a solid irrigation choice or solid fertilizer choice or even a crop rotation choice if you don't have the right information. And so we measure everything. It's a totally voluntary thing that it's helped us become better farmers, and I think you'll find most of the people in our basin are adopting the same technology. We're by no means the special ones that are just out doing this stuff. Pretty much every farm in the area has got a cell phone that they can turn their pivots on and off with and check their pumps and all that kind of stuff. And anymore, all of them are measuring water use. It's what we've been able to use as an industry to make the most effective decisions we can. So, and it's worked very well on our farm in our basin. And as you've heard multiple times today, every basin in this state is different. This technology probably wouldn't work in a few basins, wouldn't be cost effective, and in other basins it works very well. So, questions?
Thank you. Questions for Jake? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. Thanks for your report. Really interesting. Talk a little bit about the access to reliable, affordable baseload power for what you guys are doing out there with your pumping and apparatus. Obviously, it takes electricity to turn these things
a lot
off.
We work really closely with our local power company to try to make sure that we have consistent, uninterruptible power. And they understand, if we lose water or power for 2 days in the middle of the summer, we've just lost a whole potato crop on a field or an onion crop or whichever. And so we've worked really hard with them to make sure that we've got reliable, redundant systems. Power is definitely getting more expensive, and that's one of the things that has been driving these costs as well, that these saving measures.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Representative Bentz.
Mr. Chair, and I appreciate all the work your family's done on water systems in that area. It's been nothing short of amazing dedication and work. From a capital-intensive standpoint, no one goes out there and starts a farm on 10 acres anymore. Am I right there? Maybe somebody does, but they're
on 10 acres, area. 100 acres, probably not.
Exactly. So the question would be, when it comes to using water the way that you just explained to us, you're talking in the millions, multi-millions of dollars for the systems, the pumping systems. The exposure you guys have to risk must be astounding when it comes to international markets and all the other stuff that you're doing up there. Without water, it wouldn't work at all. But what struck me over the 40 years I've been watching what you guys have been doing is how much more expensive it's become to play in that venue up there.
Right.
Am I right there or just imagining?
Yes. No, you're very right. And part of the reason, the biggest thing that's driven that cost is access to water. They're not making much more of it, right? And so by going through and doing these projects we've been doing to get the mainline arteries in, doing the mitigation projects and that kind of stuff, that's going to be the first time in 30 years that outside of conserved water rights that we've been able to access new water that will be able to irrigate new ground and stuff like that. And so supply and demand has been a large part of it. And I'll say supply and demand not just on the land base, but also on the food supply base and the food safety base. We can grow food pretty safe.
Right.
Follow up.
Right. And the purpose of my question is to just raise the level of awareness of our committee to the amount of money it costs to engage in that degree of care in the application of that water, and what is it in that valley or that basin that that allows you to invest those incredible sums in that space? What is it that Is it rich uncles, or is it
hardly
the lottery? What is it?
It's back to the opportunity that we have and the climate that we have and the processor-driven demand that we have because of the soil types we have, the command. You know, that's what's set the high-value crops up that has allowed for the, you know, has generated the capital to, frankly, conserve some of this water and to do some of these projects. And, I'll be, you know, I got a full-time IT guy. And I don't, you know, you won't find most farms of some critical mass do. And it's, I mean, that's their job, is to.
And again, follow up?
Sure. Follow up.
So the point of this is that it's, you guys are able to engage in that very, very refined method of water application because you have really high value crops that are, yes, in turn driven by the fact that there's a set of processing plants now there in Hermiston and in that area.
Right.
And also, not to mention, the transload facility up at Wallula, yep, which allows you to ship 100-unit trains primarily to the east, as I understand it. But all of those systems functioning together allow you to measure the water, apply it in very, very finite ways in what I would say is a most industrial fashion, as compared to many other places in Oregon that don't enjoy access to anything I just said.
Right.
That's the nature of my question, is to get across to everybody, this ain't happening everywhere, and there's a, well, wait a minute, perhaps in the Molalla area where we have high-value things like shrubs and bushes that are sold to people in Portland. Perhaps we're, you engage, have the level of crops that allow us to engage in that kind of refined water application system. But maybe I have it wrong. That's why I'm asking.
No, I think you're 100% right. This, to be able to afford this kind of technology and operate at this level, it does take those opportunities to be able to grow something special that is worth a lot. And, you know, like your example of shrubs is 100% accurate. We don't grow shrubs on our side of the state. You know, they can grow them here, and they do a very good job of it.
Yeah.
You know, we can grow things on that side of the state that are worth a lot that they can't grow here, but they're both worth a lot. They both have, you know, they both use a resource that's probably on our side of the state's a little bit more finite, but.
And last thing, the finite, thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence, that the amount of investment in that area is in the billions.
Yes.
My understanding is there's $2 billion invested in the Hermiston Boardman area,
mm,
in food processing facilities, rail facilities, transload facilities, freight facilities, not to mention all of the irrigation systems.
Right. ConAgra's new flagship plant in Boardman was $300 million.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you.
That's the largest French fry plant they have in the whole system.
Right. Thank you.
Jake, thank you for, yep, joining us. We really appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Can
one last.
Sorry,
rep
I just
power.
Want to clarify something, because what I heard both of you say just now is that this technology is only used in two areas in the state. I quickly pulled up the website.
No, no.
So I wanted to clarify this. I mean, the outfit that provides this technology based on the logo that was on your phone screenshots.
They do it all over the world.
Widely available. Okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, they're doing this same thing all over the world in different places. In Saudi Arabia, they've got a couple farms on the Nile. They got some stuff in Brazil. They've got, I mean, yeah. So this is, the technology is being used all over. I was being more general and specific to Oregon in general. Yeah. I mean, there's companies that use different levels of this technology all over the state even. But combining them all together isn't used too widely outside of the Columbia Basin.
Good. Thank you, Jake, very much for your presentation, and thank you for traveling again.
Yes, thank you.
At this time, I'm going to invite our team from the Secretary of State's Audit Division up to give us an overview of the audit that came out, I think it was in the summer, right? And so, committee members, if you want a copy of the audit and you haven't already seen it, it's on OLIS for today's meeting. And welcome. And go ahead and start with whoever's ready to start.
Good afternoon, Chair Helm, members of the committee. My name is Steve Elzinga. I'm the Governmental and Legal Affairs Director for the Secretary of State. And we're here today to discuss the audit of the Water Resources Department that was completed in December of 2016 under former Secretary Atkins. And we want to highlight several recommendations made by our auditing team to help the department better manage the state's finite water supply for addressing current and future needs. The department needs to balance issuing and managing water rights with water resource protection and sustainability. It should also increase focus on groundwater protection, data collection and analysis, and workload and staffing issues. To better meet its mission, the department needs a long-term agency plan to strategically focus and prioritize its efforts and align them with available resources. For a more in-depth discussion of the audit, I'm pleased to introduce several of our hardworking members of our auditing team.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Helm and members of the committee. My name is Sharon Blazing. I'm an audit manager with the Secretary of State Audits Division. And with me this afternoon is Bonnie Crawford, who also worked on this audit. I'll be providing you with an overview of our 2016 audit of Oregon Water Resources Department. Oregon, like other states, is facing growing challenges with its water resources. As you know, parts of the state are experiencing regular and large-scale water supply availability issues. Many of Oregon's water sources have been fully allocated, and supply falls short of demand nearly every year in many places throughout the state. Groundwater is not available everywhere, and in some areas, it is being used faster than nature can replenish it. For example, there are 22 specific geographic areas where groundwater availability has declined and some water use is restricted. Oregon's water laws are based on the doctrine of prior appropriation, like several other Western states. However, since water needs, use, and availability are so diverse between states and water management happens fairly independently at the state level, there are not national standards the agency can look to. Water rights management looks very different from state to state. While there is not an overall consensus on water management, there are some practices to consider to lower the risk of water overuse and waste, some of which we will mention in our discussion of the audit results. The objective of our audit was to determine what actions the Water Resources Department, or WRD, can take to better manage and protect Oregon's water supply for future sustainability. We found WRD could better balance its responsibilities for managing current water demands and planning for future water needs, and enhance its focus on groundwater protection, data collection and analysis, and workload and staffing. A long-term agency plan would help WRD strategically focus and prioritize the agency's efforts and align them with available resources. WRD faces battle barriers in integrating long-term water availability and resource stewardship in its water supply management. For example, how the state approaches water right management, first in time, first in right, has not really changed since the early 1900s. Also, WRD cannot change or alter existing water rights unless the water right holder agrees. Further, the WRD division that focused on conservation, basin planning, and interagency coordination was eliminated over 15 years ago. Lastly, it can sometimes take a decade to resolve a water conflict, and in that time, WRD has limited recourse to stop illegal water use. Most WRD resources and efforts are focused on water supply needs through managing water rights. In recent years, there have been additional efforts like the Integrated Water Resource Strategy to be more oriented towards long-term water supply. However, we found the small number of programs for flow restoration and conservation WRD administers has had minimal participation, and there have been limited efforts to encourage additional participation. Water management conservation plans are another sustainability tool which describe a municipality strategy for managing water supplies. However, there is no standard level of detail required, and most agricultural users are not required to participate in these plans. We found shortcoming in the agency's well inspection program as well. According to WRD, Oregon currently has 256,000 known wells, not counting several thousand unknown wells and new wells being built each year. We noted that WRD lacks the staff capacity to inspect every new well in addition to older and abandoned wells. The agency's well inspectors physically inspect less than half of new wells statewide. Poorly constructed and sealed wells can lead to decreased water availability and groundwater contamination. Further, there are limited requirements to become a licensed well driller in Oregon compared to some other states. For example, Wisconsin requires an additional year of experience and multiple specific conditions have to be met. Similarly, we found shortcomings around collecting and analyzing water supply and use data. One of the biggest challenges is the amount of staff time required to perform meaningful and in-depth analysis. Basin studies provide some of the most reliable insight into surface water and groundwater trends and interactions. Yet only about one-third of the state has been covered by basin studies, and some of those are several decades old. Some states have fuller coverage and continue to update all their basin studies on a regular basis. Also, WRD has collected 17 years worth of stream flow measurements, 17 years worth of stream flow measured subsequent to 1987, but with limited resources has not analyzed the data. So current water availability models are based on data that's at least 30 years old. Another challenge is the lack of a centralized database, making sharing between agency staff and divisions time-consuming and less accurate. Besides sharing data within the agency, there are opportunities to increase coordination and accuracy of data by working with other agencies such as DEQ. Further, there is less specific information available about how much water is actually used across the state. Only about 20% of water rights holders are required to report how much water they use to WRD. Most agricultural users are not required to report total water use. Despite this lack of information, WRD generally does not restrict issuing water rights unless there are specified restrictions, such as those in some basin plans and rules. Therefore, the agency has continued to approve new water rights unless it has proof that it would injure other users, water availability, or the environment. We also found growing demands on the agency, differing workloads, and diminished field staff capacity compromised the agency's ability to effectively monitor and regulate Oregon's water supply. Field staff are crucial for monitoring stream water levels and diversion points, taking stream flow and observation well measurements, regulating water per water rights, preventing illegal and wasteful water use, inspecting well construction, and ensuring dam safety. They also comment on water right applications, respond to inquiries from the public, conduct water right research, and respond to water related complaints. Field staff coverage has not kept pace with the growing workloads or expectations. Overall, WRD staffing has increased marginally since 2001, but field staff numbers have declined, and some specific areas have experienced gaps in staff coverage. Our audit found that while WRD plays a key role in Oregon's integrated water resource strategy, it struggles to strategically focus agency efforts towards meeting its mission and goals. While WRD leads the planning efforts and it uses that strategy as a guide for agency priorities each biennium, the strategy does not cover all aspects of WRD's responsibilities. WRD would benefit from its own long-term agency plan, which could help establish priorities and goals, align resources and workload, improve communication, and identify needed process improvements. We made several recommendations to help WRD better manage and protect Oregon's water supply for future sustainability. These include the following. Further integrate sustainability considerations into its water management decisions to better meet its full mission, including expanding permit conditions, developing mitigation initiatives and opportunities, and encourage stream flow restoration efforts. Work with the Water Resources Commission and legislature to ensure water laws and rules for managing water meet current and future needs. Further promote water conservation among all water users, enhance its well regulation efforts, coordinate with other agencies to consolidate efforts and protect groundwater from potential risk, strategically collect and analyze the information needed to help with decision making related to the state's water supply and availability, expand its review and analysis of water use in the state, assess field staff workload and alignment with mission-critical priorities and available resources. Develop a long-term plan for the agency that prioritizes its responsibilities and sets clear, measurable goals for water sustainability. And lastly, better communicate agency priorities, goals, and resource needs to the Commission and the legislature. The agency generally agreed with our recommendations. As this audit was recently released in December, we have not yet completed follow-up work on the recommendations, but we'll be doing so later this year. Thank you for your time, and we'd be happy to answer any questions about the audit work.
Committee members, questions? Representative Holder.
I'm just curious. I was just kind of looking at all this, and it looks like there's a lot of resources needed to accomplish all those things noted in your audit. Was there any thought about what a good mechanism for getting that revenue in to invest in those resources would be?
That's a policy question up to the legislature.
Well, I just thought maybe your audit might have found a good one.
Chair Helm, Representative Holby, we do look at what other states do, and we mentioned some of those throughout. So, and you obviously heard earlier, you know, resources are a major issue. But so we tried to identify ways within existing resources, some best practices, but yes, you are correct. That is a big resource request. And I think one of the things that we really tried to highlight was the staffing levels within the agency itself. You know, so much of this work depends on the staff out in the field being able to do, you know, and we only mentioned part of what they actually do. So I think resources even within the agency is a challenge.
Follow up, Mr. Chair, just real quick. And so you sort of mentioned that you did look at other states and how they fund these sorts of things. No?
Sorry. Chair Helm, members of the committee, we did not look at how other states fund. We do know that, you know, a lot of our neighboring states certainly have a much larger budget for this type of work. They have a larger larger staff in agencies similar to this, but we didn't look specifically at how to fund that.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Brock-Smith.
Thanks, and thank you so much for the report, and somewhat in alliance, not quite towards funding as Representative Holby, but I noticed in the report that there's a lot more information that's needed, and so I'm wondering, in regards to the various basins, do informational needs and management needs differ by basin throughout the state?
Chair Helm and members of the committee, I'm Bonnie Crawford, the staff auditor. I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
So the report state talks about the need for more information. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, when you're looking at the various basins that are throughout the state in the report, there's informational needs, there's management needs. Mm-hmm. How do they differ?
Well, the informational needs do vary by basin, in part because some basins have had recent basin studies done, some have not had recent basin studies done, and the needs of the basins vary, so the management tends to vary quite a bit. What the agency would need to do is to really examine that and to have more of a targeted approach to their collection and analysis efforts, and to do that at the basin level would probably be wise. And other states, such as Wyoming, do take that approach.
Well,
I hope that answers your question.
So you brought up Wyoming, and so would you agree, and it might be a policy question, that Oregon already has more of a progressive approach in the western states with regards to promoting and supporting in-stream values of water?
In-stream values. Members of the committee and Representative Helm. Yes, in some aspects we do. We do have in-stream leasing program. We have the conserved water allocation program. As Sharon mentioned, we have the water management and conservation planning, which as far as I know, there is not another state that has an equivalent program to that. However, in terms of data collection and basin level planning, There is more work that we can do to ensure that we do have all the information that we need to make the decisions at both the basin and the state level.
Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Power.
So I was looking over the section talking about future availability of water, and it noted that in the next, a couple decades, by 2050, Oregon could be faced with the need for an additional 424 billion gallons of water. The rest of this section then talks about wildfire and drought driven by climate change. Does that, but it wasn't clear to me, does that figure take into account climate variations, or is this just projected continued growth in population and irrigation demand?
Chairman Hellman, Representative Power, that figure actually came from the Water Resources Department's own future forecast, which was based off of a variety of different factors, which includes projected growth, and I believe it did also include some climate change factors. I don't have it in front of me, so I can't speak more specifically to that.
But, okay, we could look.
But we can certainly look.
Thank you.
Very good. Well, thank you very much for doing the overview of the audit. It's very valuable to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Tom, do you still want a couple minutes?
Come on.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Beiler. I'm the director of the Oregon Water Resources Department, and I know you've had a long day, and it's getting close to the end, but I do appreciate a chance to check in with you on the performance audit. First of all, if I may, I just want to thank the auditors for their work. They took on a very complex area of programs within this agency. So I think you're getting, if you haven't already had an appreciation for that, you're getting that now. I thought they did a very thorough job. I'm not unaccustomed to the audit world. Before working at Water Resources, I worked at OWEB, where we had audits every biennium, both fiscal audits every biennium, and we also had a performance audit there. I think it's good governance to have the audit function. And from my vantage point, as the director of the agency, I understand that we're not a perfect organization, that we're looking to be as good as we can be with the resources that we have. And kind of an ethic of continuous improvement is what we try to instill with our staff and do the best we can. The audit results did provide some good advice for us, some good perspective. There weren't really any big surprises. We know we have a big workload. We know there's a lot that needs to be done that we are not always able to address. But in particular, I just wanted to emphasize that the planning recommendation, I think, is a strong one, and one that I met with our commission last month, talked about the audit report for a couple of hours. They took it very seriously, which is good. Our staff are taking it seriously, but we think that the probably the best initial focus is around the long-term planning element. And we think that by covering that, we can not only help give some direction under the auspices of the Integrated Water Resources Strategy. We already have a lot of this lined out in terms of the big picture, but it will help us tie that big picture into some more specific prioritization and then tie that to work plans for our staff and make their work more meaningful and or more better connected to the higher level policy objectives that we have. So I think that's good advice. I think that's good for our organization and where we're at right now, and got the blessing from our chair to move in that direction. So I expect over the coming year plus we will be engaged in that effort, and by doing so I think we'll carry on some of the and cover some of the other recommendations that are lined out in this report. So I think I'll pause there and just see if there are any questions.
Any questions for Tom?
Well, Mr. Chair, I didn't know if you heard my questions. I don't know if you wanted to expound on
Mr. Chair, if you could repeat the questions, Representative Brocksmith.
Well, it had to do with the informational and management needs as they vary within basins.
Yes.
And then the follow-up was the Western states and Oregon and...
Gotcha. Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Brocksmith. Different basins definitely are different, as you heard from the Secretary of State's office staff. Not all the needs are the same. They're on the dry side of the state. We experience scarcity at times, whether there's a declared drought or not, just by nature of the resource. And that means different management. That means, and it tends to mean, there's a greater desire to understand what's happening with the water. We try to adjust our resources and management along those lines. I do think that over time we're going to see the types of issues and higher demand over water, over a relatively finite resource, creates a lot of the issues that you heard from previous panelists, where you need to do more. But as it is, we look at the issues on the coast very differently than we look in the Harney Basin, and we adjust our programs accordingly and want to make sure that our management meets those needs effectively. So on your second point or question around how does Oregon compare from the standpoint of protecting conservation values within the water resources world, I'd say that we have a long and well-deserved reputation of being ahead of many states in that regard. A lot of the authority that we have relative to being able to lease in-stream water rights or to be able to allow for conservation and efficiency projects to occur, which creates some saved water that can be then used for additional out-of-stream uses as well as being committed in-stream. Those were developed in the late 1980s and into the 90s, and we're still using those and utilizing those in many cases around the state. Those aren't available in every state, and so from that standpoint, I think there's a more opportunity here to do things. I also think that there's a culture among within the natural resources world of an interest in collaboration that you see in Oregon more than some other states. And we certainly want to try to take advantage of that everywhere we can in working with communities and individuals on their water issues. I think some of the other states have made some developments over the years, but I consider Oregon to be a little bit ahead compared to most states.
Thank you, Director.
Further questions? Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Again, thanks to all the folks that came and testified today. We really appreciate it very much. And with that, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Environment and Energy. House Committee on Environment and Energy.